welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, April 25th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. Let's start off today with the article, A Final Resting Place. A surprise find in Cedar Falls, boys in 1898 tombstone returned to Canada. When the city sends a crew to clean up a property littered with junk, workers don't expect to find much worth reclaiming. That makes Greg Reckward's efforts to trace the origins of a startling discovery more than a year ago outside of one house all the more remarkable. Reckward, Cedar Falls code enforcement officer, was with a crew cleaning up the yard of what he said was a hoarder's house October 31st, 2019. "We filled almost a garbage truck at this place," he said, recounting the days months later. Cleaning up properties is a step the city takes 4 to 6 times per year after going through the courts. If the owner of a parcel deemed a nuisance doesn't work with code enforcement, a court order to abate the problem is obtained. As the cleanup crew sifted through items and hauled them into the truck, people started calling Reckward over. He saw the looks on their faces while walking across the yard. "What did you do, see a ghost?" he recalled asking them. The response was, "Well, kind of." The workers showed him the white stone grave marker they had dug out from the surrounding detritus. "Of all days to find a tombstone, we found it on Halloween," said Reckward. "A simple marble slab, the stone appeared to be in good condition. It had an engraving of an open book under an arch at the top. On its pages were the words, 'Asleep in Jesus.' A name, a Bible verse, and other information were clearly etched onto its surface. It read, 'Loving memory of Joseph Goodwin,' and listed his age at 15 at death. But the lack of weathering didn't indicate Goodwin had lived any time recently. The tombstone said he died November 9th, 1898, more than 122 years ago. A crew member asked Reckward if they should throw away the slab. The property owner wasn't likely to be of any help in explaining where it came from, since repeated efforts to contact that person had been unsuccessful. But the code enforcement officer decided the marker's fate should be different than the pile of refuse they were hauling away that day. It represented the life of a person who died at a young age and, if possible, should be returned to the spot where he was buried," Reckward believed. "So I had the police do a property case as soon as I found that night. In the meantime, he hoped to find the resting place of Joseph Goodwin with a little research. It was out of respect and honor. It's taking care of your neighbors," said Reckward. He couldn't know then the length that would be necessary to track down the tombstone's origins or how far it would have to travel to reach its destination. And then there's a subheader here. It says, "Distant Beginnings." Reckward started searching online, Googling Goodwin's name, age, and year of death. He came up with a number of hits quickly, narrowed down his inquiry to a Joseph Goodwin who died in the Canadian province of Ontario. "This was the only one that was 1898, he said, although the death date wasn't right. Reckward made contact with the police department in Ontario, but he couldn't convince anyone he spoke with that a tombstone in Cedar Falls, Iowa had any connection to their province. I think I posted it on Facebook and my friend saw it, and he told his friend," Reckward said. His friend, Tom Wagner of Waterloo, does genealogy research. However, he didn't have access to a database for international research. So Wagner contacted Alan Cable, someone who was able to do that research. Through Cable's efforts, documents were found that correlated the name and death date to what was engraved on the tombstone. The evidence Reckward returned to Canadian officials with overcame their skepticism and connected the stone to a particular place. The record of deaths Cable unearthed indicated Joseph Goodwin had consumption, more commonly known as pulmonary tuberculosis. He died after the bursting of a blood vessel, according to the document. Goodwin was born at Cat Lake in northwestern Ontario, the death record said, where an Ojibwa First Nation Reserve is located. My apologies for mispronunciation there. It said his residence was the Lac Seul Mission, and his religious denomination was the Church of England. An American mission church was located at on the Lac Seul First Nation Reserve, about 70 miles south of his birthplace. He may have been buried in its graveyard. Some of those graves go back to the 1800s, and that's where we think it originated from, said Clifford Bull, the Lac Seul First Nation chief. The Ojibwa Band's 104 square mile reserve is about 13-hour drive, nearly 700 miles north of Cedar Falls. It's 200 miles northeast of International Falls, Minnesota, stretching from north shore of Lost Lake to the southeast shore of Lac Seul Lake. The reserve had about 860 residents at three settlements 5 years ago, according to the information on its website. The band had a total registered population of 3,372. It is part of a sparsely populated region filled with lakes, rivers, and forests. The largest town near the reserve is Sioux Lookout, which has a population of 5,600 5,600. Frenchman's Head, one of the Lake Saul settlements, is about 25 miles from the town, while the other two settlements, Kiek Bay and Whitefish Bay, are each 40 miles away. Bull doesn't know how the tombstone of a tribal forebear traveled so far from the reserve, although he has a theory that it relates to long and unresolved grievances with the Canadian and provincial governments. And then another subheader, Dam Floods Land. 30 years after Goodwin's death, the Lake of the Woods Control Board unveiled a plan to construct a dam at the Ear Falls on the English River. Located at the west end of Lake Saul Lake, this would enable water storage for hydroelectric power generation. However, it also threatened to flood some of the Lake Saul First Nation Reserve, established in a 1873 treaty with Canada. Nonetheless, dam operations began in May of 1929. When the dam was created, the land was never surrendered and the flooding was illegal, said Bull. Historical information from the band explained that the control board, with two members, each representing Canada and Ontario, never acquired the rights to the reserve land. The Department of Indian Affairs approved the flooding without the consent of the Lac Seul officials. An account from the band suggests that the water levels weren't a major problem with when the dam first began operating. After Canadian authorities told Lake Saul representatives in 1933 that those levels wouldn't increase by more than a foot, the lake rose much higher during the next 4 years. By 1938, 17 square miles of the First Nations land were underwater. A number of buildings on the reserve, including the Anglican Church and the Hudson Bay Trading Post, were rebuilt at a higher elevation to get them out of the path of flooding. Lake Saul Lake was totally flooded, around 13 feet of water, said Bull. He noted that we lost 80 homes, wild rice field disappeared, and a lot of graves went underwater. The flood desecrated the land. With the lake serving as a reservoir, water levels fluctuate throughout the year. And that unearthed painful reminders of what happened more than 90 years ago. What we have is erosion here, said Bull. In the springtime, the water recedes and you're able to walk on the beach. And sometimes you're able to find skeletal remains. Those are then reburied on higher ground. Bull suggests that a tombstone like Goodwin's could have been similarly displaced due to the flooding and then emerged as the water receded. What possibly could have happened is someone was driving along one day and said, "Hey, here's this tombstone. Let's take it," he theorized. If those who took it were from the United States, that could have been how the tombstone made its way back to a place like Cedar Falls. Now back to another subheader. Still in court. The effort to resolve the dispute over the government's taking of the Lake Saul land is still ongoing, although it hasn't been continuously active during the decades since the dam was first built. In 1943, Canada paid Lac Seul First Nation $50,263 in compensation for the flooding. Information from the band indicates, but concerns over the adequacy of that amount were raised by a chief in the 1970s, and the band embarked on multiple years of research and then claims process. Claims were filed in 1991 in federal court and Ontario Superior Court against Canada and the province, according to the band, negotiations began with Canada in 1995 and continued for 13 years without resolution. Laxalt restarted the claims process in federal court against Canada, which led to a $30 million compensation award in 2017. The court ruled that the Canadian government had breached its fiduciary duties to the band under the nearly 150-year-old treaty and other laws. However, the Laxalt band, which had sought more than $500 million, wanted a new trial. "It destroyed our community, and then we took the government to court for flooding our land," said Bull. "We're still in court today." Media reports said that the Supreme Court of Canada heard the First Nations appeal of the compensation award on December 8th. Bull expected to hear a decision from the court by this summer. Ontario Power Generation, the company that now operates the dam, wanted to build a second hydroelectric power plant at Ear Falls nearly two decades ago. But Laxalt's then-chief and counsel filed an injunction in the courts to bring the company to the table and make an agreement with the band. That allowed the construction to get underway in 2006. Since the dam began operations in 2009, Laxalt First Nation has a 25% revenue-sharing agreement with the power company, said Bull. The 2.5-megawatt generating unit brings profits of $400,000 to $500,000 annually to the band. This is the final subheader. Long journey. The Tombstone started its journey to Ontario at the end of February 2020, but days later it was held up by paperwork at the Canadian border. "It was stuck at the border for a very long time," said Bull. "Finally, in late fall, it continued the rest of the way to the town of Hudson, just south of the Laxalt Reserve." The First Nation band operates the Laxalt Training Center of Excellence, which provides a certified training program and some workshops in the town of about 500 people. "Someone put it in our training center," said Bull. "It was sitting in a closet in the training center for a few more weeks." He learned of its arrival after being elected chief of the First Nations band in early November. On December 9th, he drove his pickup over to Hudson to get the tombstone. While band officials are aware of people who share the name of the long-deceased 15-year-old, Bull said that they don't know the exact relation because the family tree of the Goodwin family didn't go back that far. Still, Bull took the grave marker to Frenchman's Head, about 5 miles from Hudson, and brought to the home of 67-year-old Simon Goodwin, who has long ties to the area. He worked at a sawmill in Hudson for 35 years, and for the Laxalt band another 10 years. He is now retired, but still doing some work for the band as a security guard with the Laxalt Police. He first heard of Joseph Goodwin in 2019 from the previous Laxalt chief. "He had been waiting a long time to receive the tombstone memorializing the boy. I don't really know who he is," Goodwin confessed when reached by phone in late December. "He's probably a distant relative of mine. And," he added, "I don't know how the heck the tombstone got down there. I'm glad that it's returned, and now it can be put back in its resting place." Goodwin doesn't know exactly where it should be, but plans to figure it out. "There were Goodwins on the north shore of Laxalt," he said. "Over the years, they have migrated all over northern Ontario. When the tombstone arrived in the middle of winter, he noted that there was no way of taking it up the north shore across the lake. He expected to travel there by boat this summer. We'll probably have to find a place to put it and do a little ceremony," said Goodwin. Now, let's move on to the article. Is this an asterisk Oscars? Odd year may be sign of the future. In 93 years of existence, the Oscars have been postponed by shootings, the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., and the attempted killing of Ronald Reagan, and by a flood when the 1938 rainstorms overwhelmed the Los Angeles River. Sunday's ceremony will be the first Academy Awards delayed by a pandemic. After a year that erased movie titles from the marquees and sent seismic shockwaves through Hollywood, the show is going on. 2 months later than usual, in a crowdless ceremony at the LA Union Station, with a batch of nominees that have barely played in movie theaters, The biggest box office of the Best Picture nominees belong to Promising Young Woman, a pandemic blockbuster with $6.3 million in U.S. ticket sales. That this is all very strange goes without saying. Given such an unusual year, this year's awards have been called the Asterisk Oscars. But there is reason to believe, and even hope, that some of this year's changes are here to stay. The broadcast, beginning at 7 p.m. CDT, Sunday on ABC, after a red carpet pre-show, will be the most transformed in decades. The show's producers, led by filmmaker Steven Sondberg, are pledging an entire makeover, one perhaps long overdue for an institution resistant to innovation. They plan to treat the awards more like a movie, including shooting it in 24 frames per second rather than the typical 30. Zooms are strictly forbidden. Instead, tested and quarantined maskless nominees will gather at the downtown train station, while satellite feeds connect others from around the world. On the heels of a humbling year, the Oscars, usually a frothy night of self-congratulations, this year may feel more like a therapeutic rally for an industry in the midst of a convulsive change. Just weeks leading up to the Academy Awards saw one of Los Angeles's most iconic movie theaters, the Cinemera Dome, along with ArcLight Cinemas, go out of business. When the Walt Disney Co. announced that it would delay Black Widow from May to July and open it both theatrically and on Disney Plus, cinemas shuttered. Adding to the sense of wholesale change was the news that Searchlight Pictures, Nancy Utley and Steve Gillua, who had steered so many of the Oscar winners, including this year's Best Picture favorite Chloe Zhao's Nomadland, were stepping down. Even as the pandemic is winding down, I don't know that we're going to return to business as usual, said Darnell Hunt, dean of the UCLA's College of Social Sciences, who studies Hollywood. That's good news, too. 2020 saw, Hunt says, profound diversity, unlike any year before. In a study released Thursday and authored by Hunt and Anna Christiana Raman, researchers saw that 42% of roles overall and 39.7% of lead roles in 2020 were played by actors of color, roughly in line with U.S. population demographics. There are many caveats. Representation still lags behind the camera and among executives. With many of the biggest studio films put on hold, smaller, lower-budget films, many of them streamed, were much of 2020's atypical output. But the diversity of those films has also been transferred to the Oscars. In recent years, the Film Academy, which this year extended eligibility by 2 months and to films that bypass movie theaters, has made strides in expanding its membership. In coming years, the Academy will institute inclusion standards in the Best Picture category. A record 9 of the 20 acting nominees are non-white. If Viola Davis from Ma Rainey's Black Bottom and Chadwick Boseman, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, Yu Jung Yeon, my apologies for mispronunciation there, from the movie Minari, and Daniel Kaluuya, Judas and the Black Messiah, all win, as they did at the Screen Actors Guild Awards, it would be the first time people of color swept the acting awards, and a dramatic reversal of the recent years of Oscars so white. More women are nominated than ever before. 2, Emerald Fennell from Promising Young Woman and Zhao are nominated for the Best Director for the first time. Only 5 women have ever been nominated until now. Zhao, the clear frontrunner, is poised to be the only second woman to ever win the award, and the first woman of color. Yes, it's an odd year, but with a class of widely admired films and roughly applauded nominees from groups that have historically been marginalized by the Academy, a sea change in Hollywood is set to stringingly take the stage. This is clearly a watershed moment for the Oscars, says Hunt. It shows us what's possible. If you go for generations without ever acknowledging the actors, directors, and writers of color, it's hard to break out of that pattern. Now we're creating a whole new culture of what's Oscar-worthy. Streaming, a different animal, says Hunt, has played a major role in making the film industry more inclusive. But it's also disrupted and morphed movie culture. The Oscar nominees, like most films in the past year, were watched largely at home in more solitary settings than packed in theaters that usually feed the buzz of Oscar season. Nomadland found its largest audience after a theatrical run on Hulu. Netflix leads all studios with 36 nominations. Movies are more widely and more easily accessible on streaming services, but their grip on popular culture is less potential, less firm amid oceans of digital content. According to a survey last month, 1,500 active entertainment consumers by the research of firm Guts Plus Data, not many people are familiar with this year's Oscars nominees. Some 35% of them hadn't heard of any of the eight films up for Best Picture. Warner Bros. Judas and the Black Messiah ranked highest with 42% awareness, but only 12% had watched it. Sunday's lead nominees, Netflix's Mank, was unfamiliar to 82% of respondents. You could chalk some of that up to people having their attention elsewhere during a global pandemic, but some believe that cinemas are the missing link. On Sunday, Patrick Corcon, vice president of the National Association of Theater Owners, hopes to see a connection between movies and the movie theaters that make the experience of seeing movies so special. "I think that people already feel that, says Corcoran, and it's why the ratings for movies awards shows have fallen so precipitously this year. Movie theaters are the missing element that drives the interest in movies and lifts their presence in culture. Award shows ratings, along with everything else on linear television, had been declining more before the pandemic. Last year's Oscar broadcast, in which Bong Joon-ho's Parasite triumphed, had the smallest U.S. audience ever, with 23.6 million total viewers, according to Nielsen. But ratings have nosedived this year. The Golden Globes dropped 63% to 6.9 million viewers. The Grammys fell 51% to 9.2 million. The Oscars are sure to sink to their lowest audience ever. Less clear is if that's a part of a downward trend or another asterisk. I don't worry about it," says Sonderberg, who says he's focused on putting on the best show possible. The larger issue of whether this is a secular shift or a cyclical shift. We don't know. It's still too early to tell that, but it doesn't really meet my metrics for tragedy or outrage. And now, let's go on to the article, Prototype of the First U.S. Dollar Coins Auctioned for $840,000. A piece of copper that was struck by the U.S. Mint in Philadelphia in 1794 and was a prototype for the fledgling nation's money was auctioned off for $840,000, considerably more than expected, an official said. Heritage Auctions spokesman Eric Bradley said that No Stars Flowing Hair Dollar opened at $312,000 when it was put up Friday evening, but in less than a minute, the intense bidding quickly pushed the coin to its final auction price of $840,000. The coin, formerly owned by businessman and Texas Rangers co-chairman Bob Simpson, had been expecting to sell it for $350,000 to $500,000, Bradley said. While it closely resembles silver dollars that were later minted in Philadelphia, it gets its name because of its missing stars. Jacob Lipson of Heritage Auctions said earlier that the starless coins are considered by collectors and institutions as one-of-a-kind prototypes for the silver's examples that he would follow. Known as a pattern, the front features of the flowing hair portrait of Liberty and the date 1794, while the reverse side shows a small eagle on a rock within a wreath. Similar starless examples are part of the Smithsonian Institution National Numismatic Collection. The pattern was forgotten as the mint continued the process of creating the nation's first silver dollars. Coins collecting lore states the unique rarity was excavated from the site of the first Philadelphia mint before 1876, Limpson said. That was how the first coins owners described its history and its first auction appearance in 1890. The pattern is corroded and not in perfect condition, Lipson said, likely because it was buried at the site of the original mint. There are some scratches and other marks on its brown surfaces. It has traded hands 8 times, according to the auction house. Simpson, 73, purchased it along with other patterns in 2008 to add to his large collection. "I think coins should be appreciated almost as artwork," he said. "I have gotten more than enough joy from them." And now let's go on to the article, "Carbon Monoxide Killed Kossuth County 17-Year-Old." A 17-year-old girl who was found unconscious Monday night at a Sioux City hog confinement facility died of carbon monoxide poisoning. Victoria Mary Paralardo was found at the facility by Kossuth County Sheriff officers at around 9:10 p.m. and transported to the Kossuth Regional Health Center in Algonia, where she was pronounced dead, according to a press release issued by the Kossuth County Sheriff on Thursday. Autopsy results from the Iowa Medical Examiner's Office show Paralardo's death was accidental. Investigation at the scene revealed a power washer was being operated within the hallway area of the building near where Paralardo was working. Inadequate ventilation caused Paralardo to be overcome by the fumes. A representative of the family, who wished to remain anonymous, said that no one was at fault for Paralardo's death. "If you want to help spread awareness of carbon monoxide poisoning and how different machines and gases cause death," the representative wrote in a Facebook message. "Carbon monoxide is a colorless, odorless tasting gas, and poisoning is caused by inhaling combustion fumes. When too much of the carbon monoxide is in the air you're breathing, your body replaces the oxygen in your red blood cells with carbon monoxide. This prevents oxygen from reaching your tissues and organs, according to the information on the Mayo Clinic website. Property tax records show the deed holder of the facility is Cottonwood Investment Company and is managed by Christensen Farms of Sleepy Eye, Minnesota. Paralardo is not employed by Christensen Farms, according to an official with the company. Paralardo's mother owns the company that was hired to clean the facility Monday night. Paralardo is a member of the class of 2022 at South Central Calhoun High School." Now let's go on to Cedar Falls doctor has medical license reinstated. A Cedar Falls physician who was charged in 2017 with failing to provide appropriate pain management to multiple patients has gotten his license reinstated. Dr. Larry Standing, 56, a general medicine physician with Mercy One Bluebell Road Family Medicine, had his medical license fully reinstated April 15th after he fully complied with the Iowa Board of Medicine's terms, according to a release from the board on Thursday. In February 2017, Standing was charged by the board with failing to provide appropriate pain management for multiple patients in Cedar Falls between 2011 and 2016. Details were not provided. Standing was given a citation and a warning, ordered to pay a $5,000 civil penalty, required to complete a medical record keeping course, and barred from prescribing, administering, or dispensing controlled substances for the treatment of chronic pain, according to the board. He was still allowed to see patients during that period, with board restrictions limited to the prescribing of pain medications for chronic health conditions, as a Mercy One spokesperson said. He was also placed on probation for 5 years, and the board determined that Dr. Standing has fully complied with the terms of his board order on April 15th, and his license was reinstated free of restrictions. Now let's go on to the article, "Police Investigate Third Pizza Delivery Robbery in Same Neighborhood This Week." Police are investigating the robbery of three pizza delivery drivers in the same neighborhood in just 4 days. A Marco's Pizza driver was sent to an apartment complex on 1257 Ravenwood Road at around 8:45 p.m. Friday night and was reported robbed. The victim sustained minor injuries and his cell phone was taken, according to the police. That was just 2 days after a Papa John's driver was sent to 1229 Ravenwood Road around 4:30 p.m. Wednesday, according to the police, and reported about $20 in cash was taken from him. On Tuesday, a Pizza Hut driver was sent to 1315 Ravenwood Road around 1:40 p.m., and when she arrived, she was pushed down from behind. The attackers took her money and food and fled the scene, according to police. Police said that the driver's injuries weren't serious, as the delivery call turned out to be fake. No arrests have been made in the robberies, and police are still undergoing an investigation. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, April 25th on Iris. the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Jessica Marie Henry. Jessica Marie Henry was born January 12, 1989, in Ames, Iowa. Jessica lived with her family in Ames, Maxwell, Des Moines, Urbandale, and Norwalk. Jessica, as a young child, was able to make a wish with the Make-A-Wish Foundation to go to Hawaii and swim with the dolphins. She was a graduate of Norwalk High School in 2007. She then graduated from DMACC in May of 2018 with an associate in Applied Sciences/Paralegal. Jessica was thrilled to work as a paralegal for the Carter Law Office in Des Moines. We will miss her strength, tenacity, wit, and courage. Her bravery to get up each day in the midst of living with a rare form of muscular dystrophy was admired by all who knew her. She was an avid reader, loved to write, and an advocate for the rights of the disabled. Jessica loved Taylor Swift, coffee, movies, her family, fudge, and her BFF, Maddie. Not necessarily in that order. Jessica leaves behind her dad and mom, Steve and Jennifer Henry of Norwalk, biological mother, Belinda Minrich, two brothers, Howard Henry and Lincoln Henry, three sisters, Michelle Henry, Elizabeth Kurlikova, Abigail and Abigail McDonald, two grandmothers, Catherine Melu Baxter and Bonnie Benjamin, and grandfather, Walter Collar. Jessica also leaves behind aunts, uncles, cousins, nieces, and a nephew. She was preceded in death by her grandparents, Kenneth Baxter, Homer, and Opal Henry, and her uncle, Luke Caller. Memorial contributions may be made to the Muscular Dystrophy Association or Make-A-Wish Foundation in her name. Kenneth Floyd Hare. Kenneth, Ken, Hare, 85, passed into his heavenly home March 19, 2021 at Banner Baywood Hospital in Mesa, Arizona. Kenneth Floyd Hare was born February 9, 1936 in Waterloo, Iowa, the son of Floyd Lawrence and Mabel Lewis Hare. He attended school in Waterloo, graduating from Orange High in 1954. After high school, he attended college for 1.5 years and then enlisted in the U.S. Army, where he served for 3 years. He returned to Waterloo, accepting a 5-year apprenticeship in a meal pattern making at metal pattern making at John Deere Co. Kenneth was united in marriage to Virginia Lee Mortimer from Wisconsin on June 10, 1961, in Rochester, Minnesota. In a few years, they decided to share their lives and adopt 3 children. Charles, Virgil, and Jennifer, a joy and love never ending. Ken worked in the job shops in the Quad Cities area for 10 years. Back to John Deere in Waterloo, where he retired after 24 years on September 1, 1998. During that time, he served on the executive board of the Pattern Makers Union, later becoming the business manager of the union. He served 4 years as an assistant state director of Northeast Iowa for the Iowa State Good Sam Club, then being the state director of the club for 4 years. Many years enjoying the RVing lifestyle in the motorhome, visiting many states and events. He lived his life honoring Jesus Christ as his personal savior, was instrumental in helping start 2 churches in Moline, Illinois, and Davenport. He enjoyed and loved his family, taking them traveling and camping, playing many games, and expert at putting puzzles together. After retiring, he spent his winters in Mesa, Arizona. He is survived by his wife, sons, Charles of Grand Junction, Iowa, and Virgil of Iowa City, a daughter, Jennifer of Mesa, Arizona, 2 granddaughters, Zoe and Chloe, 1 great-grandson, Jameson of Mesa, 2 sisters-in-law, Margaret Olson and Julie Hare, and many nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents, sister, Velma Purdy and Marilyn Spear, brothers Lawrence and Robert, brother-in-law, James Olson, Edward Spear, and Elwin Purdy, and sister-in-law, Joanne Hare. Margaret E. Swanson. Margaret E. Swanson, 87, of Waverly, died Monday, April 19, 2021, of natural causes at Bartles Lutheran Retirement Center in Waverly. She was born in Bennington Township, north of Waterloo, Iowa, on March 26, 1934, daughter of Mabel E. and William Wilhelm O. Mixdorf. She graduated from West High School in Waterloo. She worked as a secretary for the majority of her life throughout United Lutheran Church of America and its affiliations. Margaret married Glenn Swanson on January 14, 1956, at First Lutheran Church, Waterloo. He died August 17, 2007. She was an active member of St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Waverly for over 56 years. Margaret is survived by son Paul of Janesville, Wisconsin, daughter Anne of Plainfield, granddaughter Alyssa Tutje of Plainfield, sister Ruth White, brother Frank Mixdorf, and numerous nieces and nephews. Preceded in death by her brother Bill Mixdorf and sisters Mary Lou Blobaum and Marlies Melsted. A public celebration of life will be held at a later date at Locke Funeral Home. Family graveside services have been held at the Memorial Park Cemetery in Waterloo. Memorials may be made to the Cedar Valley Hospice and St. Paul's Lutheran School in Waverly. For more information, visit www.lockfuneralhome.com. Irvin Walter Irv Peterson. Irvin Walter Irv Peterson, 76, of Rhinebeck, Iowa, passed away Thursday, April 22, 2021, at his home in Rhinebeck, while under the care of the Cedar Valley Hospice. Visitation will be held from 5 p.m. until 7 p.m. on Sunday, April 25, 2021, at the Abel's Funeral and Cremation Service, French Hand Chapel in Rhinebeck. Family requests masks to be worn at the visitation. The Mass of a Christian Burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Monday, April 26, at the St. Gabriel's Catholic Church in rural Rhinebeck. Masks are mandatory at the church. The Mass will be live-streamed on the St. Gabriel Church Facebook page for those who are unable to attend. Burial will follow at the Rhinebeck Cemetery with military honors conducted by the Rhinebeck American Legion Post 242. Memorials may be directed to the family. Online condolences may be made by visiting www.ablesfuneralhome.com. Irv was born on April 1, 1945, to his parents Roy and Theresa Peterson. He graduated Rhinebeck High School in the class of 1963 and was united in marriage to Joanne Pisarek on November 29, 1969, in Cedar Rapids. Irv and Joe lived in both Cedar Rapids and Central City before moving back to Rhinebeck in 1977. Irv served the United States in the Vietnam War and as an airman sergeant E-4 from August 1965 to February 1969. He was an aircraft mechanic on turboprop and fan jet aircraft. He spent time in Philippines, Japan, Korea, Thailand, Vietnam, Taiwan, and Guam. Irv was also a member of the Iowa National Guard from December 1980 to December 1987 as Sergeant E-5. He was a helicopter mechanic and an instructor at the Iowa Military Academy and a member of the Rhinebeck American Legion Post 242. Irv worked for John Deere as a machine mechanic and retired in 2009 after 30 years of service with the company. Throughout his life, he always loved to dance. His hobbies included woodworking and trap shooting. He loved to play cards and especially liked to win. Irv was known for his sense of humor and his gift of making people laugh. His true joy in life came from spending time with family and friends. Irv is survived by his wife of 51 years, Joanne Peterson, daughter Paula Kelly, son Kevin Peterson, daughter Teresa Peterson, son Chris Peterson, six grandchildren, Jeremiah, Morgan, Lucas, Kelsey, Leah, and Liam, and Finney, grandpuppy Eddie, sister Vicky, Slick, brother Ray Peterson, sister Diana Sells, and many nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents and daughter, Mary Ann. Now, let's move on to some sports articles, starting with college softball. UNI overcomes slow start and salvages DH split with Bradley. The University of Northern Iowa softball team made enough adjustments Saturday afternoon to salvage a Missouri Valley Conference doubleheader split. UNI found itself down 6 runs after the top of the 5th inning during a 6-3 Game 1 loss to Bradley. Panthers ace Kalen Packard shut the Braves down during a 4-1 victory in Game 2. She's done a fantastic job, and our team feeds off her energy, UNI coach Ryan Jacobs said of his redshirt sophomore Game 2 starter. She brings it for us and in the circle competes really hard. That is something that is easy to get behind when you're playing defense and hitting for her, because you see her passion and energy, and it makes you want to better yourself. Packard is now 10-2 against Missouri Valley Conference opponents with a 1.79 ERA. She felt her timing was off early in Game 2, with pitches often missing high. Bradley scored a run off Samantha Smith's double as the Braves sent 9 to the plate over the first two innings. UNI's defense helped Packard settle into game. In the top of the third, Emmy Wells cut off a line dive that held Stacia Seaton to a single. Third baseman Brooke Snyder fielded a hard-hit grounder during the next at-bat and fired the ball to second baseman Taylor Hogan, who relayed it over to Darylin Lamprecht for an inning-ending double play. Seeing that out of my D was huge, was because I knew that I could just throw it and trust that they had my back, Packard said. Bradley didn't have much of a chance down the stretch as Packard struck out 4 of the 5 final hitters. The UNI starter finished with 7 strikeouts versus 1 walk and scattered 6 hits. UNI's offense missed opportunities to keep pace with Bradley early in the opener before scoring 1 run each of the final 3 innings. The Braves went up 6-0 when Cameron Montier plated 3 with 2 out single in the 4th inning. The Panthers had the tying at the plate in the 7th before the grounder to a shortstop gave Braves starting pitcher Grace French a complete game victory. Lamprecht delivered for UNI's offense with 2-run opposite field homer to right with the 2 outs in the bottom of the 1st inning. Sammy Bunch doubled and scored on a sacrifice fly by Emmy Wells in the 3rd inning. Madison Parks added to a hustle double to on hit to the shallow left in the 5th before coming home on double centers by Wells. In the 2nd game, we made adjustments offensively a lot quicker, Jacobs said. We just kind of came up flat that first game. You and I entered the day game 1 ahead Illinois State in the win column and 3 games back in the first place Redbirds in the loss column in the race for the league regular season title. That big series will take place next weekend in Normal, Illinois. The Panthers conclude their set this weekend at 11 a.m. today before hosting Drake in Tuesday midweek game at Robinson Dresser Complex. I've got to do a better job on my end to make sure that we understand what we're playing for every day, Jacobs said. We're right in the thick of things for a conference championship, and you've got to come to play every day. You've got to have a level of consistency in your game, and you can't have those letdowns because you'll give up a game like we did that first one by not being ready to play. Packard says her team has come together nearing this stretch run of the season. We're fighters, Packard points out. We love to have fun. We always come out with a fight, and we're a family. We all get along so well. Now, let's go move on to the article, How UEFA President Seferin Crushed a Super League Rebellion. A moment that prepared Alexander Serafin for the stresses and tensions running European football came 3 decades ago, in a far graver moment for the continent. The law graduate was relaxing at his family home in Slovenia on June 25, 1991, sitting on the terrace with his parents, brother and sister, and their partners when a man approached. He said, "Alexander Serafin?" I said, "Yes," he said. "War has started. You go with us," Serafin recalls. "It was crazy. I was shocked." Serafin was conscripted just as his tiny nation nestled between the Alps and Adriatic Sea declared independence from multi-ethnic Yugoslavia. The response from Belgrade was to send in forces to prevent the start of a bloody breakup of the federation. It finished very soon, in 10 days, but there was a lot of tension, day and night, and threats of bombs, Serafin says. It's an experience that helps you survive if some people then try to destabilize you. The president of UEFA brought up the memory in an interview with the Associated Press in relation to the announcement last weekend of a renegade European Super League to rival the Champions League, and the belief that he was betrayed by those previously thought to be trusted friends. Psychologically, it was such a shock for me, he says, from Ljubljana, my apologies for mispronunciation. Similar to the war, you cannot compare, but both were stressful and tensions were similar. Serafin's immediate task was to stop the 12 wealthiest clubs splitting to a closed competition that is the antithesis to European football norms. Spoiled children cannot destabilize me, he says. Particularly galling for Serafin was the deception of Junivitus. So close was his relationship with Andrea Agnelli, the chairman of the Italian champions, that Serafin was the godfather to his daughter. As chairman of the European Club Association, Agnelli and the rest of the elite signed on two Fridays ago to expand the Champions League from 2024 to fend off threats by a Super League split. By the following morning, however, Serafin's concerns resurfaced that Agnelli would renege on his commitment to stick to the UEFA's competitions. When Agnelli stopped returning calls as he drove from Slovenia to Switzerland, Serafin's worst fears began to crystallize. The worst day was Saturday, because then I realized that it was pure betrayal, that some people had lied to us for years, Serafin says. It was quite strange, because I didn't know what exactly will happen the next day. By Sunday, the Super League plan that first leaked in January was being activated by 12 clubs. I got a phone call from three of our four clubs saying, "We are terribly sorry, but we have to otherwise or we're out," Serafin says. Emergency meetings were held by the English, Spanish, and Italian leagues, whose showpiece competitions would be wrecked by the severing of a link to the placing of European qualification. The English Football Association leadership contacted the administration of Prime Minister Boris Johnson to seek help to keep the national game intact. The response was a joint statement by UEFA and the leagues and federations in England, Spain, and Italy, warning the cynical project would be repelled with legal action. Any clubs joining a breakaway would be banned from playing in existing competitions. So the largest contingent, six English clubs, would be expelled from the Premier League and their players unable to represent their countries. But the group dubbed the Dirty Dozen by Serafin still launched their Super League late Sunday with a website scant on detail, particularly on women's football, and the logo roundly derided for its cheap look. Serafin was enraged. Pushing ahead with a planned briefing of the new-look Champions League, he lambasted the snakes at rebels clubs, particularly upbraiding Manchester United vice-chairman Ed Woodward and liar Agnelli. Such personalized, cutting rhetoric isn't usual for Serafin, since he being elected to UEFA president in 2016. Notably, in 2018, FIFA leader Gianni Infantino was targeted for club world expansion plans. Serafin attacked the pursuit of selfish endeavors by trying to sell the soul of football tournaments to nebulous private funds. Serafin wasted little time in trying to thwart the Super League before UEFA was dragged through the lengthy legal challenges. He was helped by Johnson threatening to introduce laws in Britain to stop an anti-competitive Super League, and by support for the Champions League from Liverpool, manager Jurgen Klopp, and the Premier League's Champions players. Fan protests swelled in England, and Serafin detected cracks showing in the Super League's alliance. With a UEFA Congress and the 55 European nations to address the Swiss resort town of Montreux on Tuesday morning, Serafin singled out the Premier League owners in a direct appeal to see sense. "Gentlemen, you've made a huge mistake," Serafin said. Some will say it's greed, others will say disdain, arrogance, flippancy, or complete ignorance of England's football culture. It does not matter. What does matter is that there is still time to change your mind. Everybody makes mistakes." The only public pronouncement by this point from the English club advocating the project was a 41-word statement from Manchester United's co-owner, Joel Glazer, which also posted on the website of Premier League's rivals, joined in the Super League: Manchester City, Liverpool, Arsenal, Tottenham, and Chelsea. Of the participants, the only owners who even occasionally speak publicly to media are Arsenal's Stan Kroenke and Liverpool's John Henry. Not even with billions of dollars to be earned from getting the Super League over the line that they would front a lobbying campaign to advocate the new competition. Had the Super League been launched a week earlier, British politicians would have been hindered in a mounting counterattack as ministers conducted no media interviews during this period of national mourning leading up to Prince Philip's funeral. But the British government was able to ride a wave of populism in advancing fan concerns and propelling the Super League resistance to the top of the political agenda. The sense of distance from the clubs by their supporters had been intensified by the pandemic keeping them out of the stadiums. Now they felt locked out of decision-making by their clubs that was transforming the football landscape. As Chelsea supporters flooded the streets around Stamford Bridge ahead of Tuesday night's game against Brighton, the Super League started to fall apart. The AP reported the Roman Abramovich-owned club was preparing to abandon the Super League. It took almost 3 hours, though, for an English club to make it official, and Abdou Dhabi, owner of Manchester City, was the first. A year after UEFA tried to unsuccessfully ban City from the Champions League for breaching financial regulations, now the team was being hailed by Seraphin as a real asset for the game. By the end of the night, the Super League had been deserted by all English clubs, some of which groveling apologetic statements, and the breakaway threat melted away as Seraphin drove back to Slovenia. Four clubs were still clinging to the Super League that blew up on launch. Rambling interviews given by Real Madrid president Florentino Perez symbolized a bungled strategy. Revenge isn't on Seraphin's mind, but suspicion will linger about the motivations of the clubs he encounters. How, though, to heal the rift with Agnelli, whose daughter Seraphin is godfather to? There is no more relationship, he says, and there never will be any relation anymore. Now, let's finish today with the article, USHL, Blackhawks finish season with 6-3 victory. The Waterloo Blackhawks fell short of the postseason, but that didn't stop the proud, storied United States Hockey League team from turning in an inspired, hard-fought effort in their final game of the season. The cowbells were ringing frequently as Waterloo charged out strong before drowning Des Moines 6-3 in penalty-filled matchup Saturday night at Young Arena. The effort our players gave the last two nights was exceptional, Waterloo coach P.K. O'Handley said. It's unfortunate that the last three games were a snapshot of what we could have been. It was good effort by our guys, and there was a lot of penalties, but our grit and competitiveness carried us through. The Blackhawks finished their season with a three-game winning streak, including back-to-back wins over Des Moines, and Young Arena fans gave their team a standing ovation following the victory. Our crowd was awesome the last two nights, O'Handley said. The young guys coming back saw that, and it is something to build on. Our crowd has always been awesome, and that's what makes this place special. Waterloo finished the season with a 14-12-1 home record. The Blackhawks were 22-30-1 overall. The Buccaneers finished 26-21 after dropping their last two games. Waterloo knocked Des Moines out of the playoffs Friday night. The season finale was marred by an abundance of penalties, primarily in the third period, between two frustrated teams not terribly fond of each other. The Blackhawks took a commanding 3-1 lead Saturday when David Guicciardi connected for a goal with just over 7 minutes left in the second period. We finished it right away and played well these last few games, said Guicciardi, who was headed to Michigan State. We had a lot of injuries this season, and that made it hard to develop the chemistry we needed. We just kept battling and playing hard. We tried to make the best of it, and I was glad we were able to put on such a show these last two nights. Shortly after Guicciardi's goal, the teams were involved in a skirmish in the front of the net. Waterloo's Ryan O'Hara was ejected after being called for game misconduct. He was escorted off the ice by an official. Two Des Moines players were assessed penalties during the same sequence. The Blackhawks quickly capitalized when Ethan Skismalier, my apologies for mispronunciation there, scored on a power play goal to stake his team to a 4-1 lead. The lead grew to 5-1 just 20 seconds into the third period when Waterloo's Alex Gaffney fired in a rebound for his second goal of the evening. Just 2 minutes later, Waterloo's Tucker Ness was ejected after fighting with Sam Reland of Des Moines at the center ice. Ness was kicked out for game misconduct. Reland was not ejected, but assessed a 5-minute penalty for fighting. The Buccaneers responded with back-to-back goals to close within 5-3 with 11 minutes and 34 seconds left in regulations. Waterloo added a Max Sasson goal with a minute left to lead 6-3 after Des Moines had it pulled its goalie. The Blackhawks had a young team that battled through its share of injuries and setbacks during the 2020-2021 campaign, but the Blackhawks continued to battle in the regular season finals days. "This was as close of a full lineup as we've had," O'Handley said. "We have to sort all of that out and dissect what happened. We felt we had a good team if we had all of our guys together. We were never able to do it for a bunch of different reasons." Waterloo struck first Saturday when Gaffney connected from close range. His early goal gave the Blackhawks a 1-0 lead less than 5 minutes into the game. Des Moines tied the game 1-1 on an Alex Lafferty tally late in the first period, but Waterloo came right back to grab a 2-1 lead when Owen Ozar delivered with a goal. Ozar found the net for the 15th time this season. Blackhawk goalie Charlie Glockner was superb in net, stopping 5 of 16 shot attempts in the first two periods. Glockner is headed to Northern Michigan next season. "These were our playoff games. We were playing for pride," Glockner said of the final home series. "We came out really determined and wanted to finish strong. We jumped on them early and tried to outwork them. We had a blast out there. It was a fun way to end the season. The fans were unbelievable. They've been by our side all season. It was an awesome experience to play in front of them. Their support means a lot." Waterloo battled its share of issues with all the protocols it had to follow during the season during the COVID pandemic. "It's been a crazy, crazy year, that's for sure," O'Handley said. "What you make of it, I don't know." And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, April 25th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.